Judiciary Committee, including, send the recording to order. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2767. And, paying the gavel, and the one and only witness, the Honorable Karen Minnis.
This is the first. This is a nepotism. Yeah, this is.
All right, this is emotional. I'm going to get emotional.
Yeah.
This is sentimental stuff, folks.
Rick, this is, you know what's happening here?
Yes, sir. Yes. No, I'm sorry.
This is emotional.
Sorry.
Sorry, Madam Majority Leader.
All right, Representative.
Go ahead and apologize.
You better speak up before it gets completely.
What abuse a House member has to take in this committee. Actually, this is a serious subject. House Bill 2767. For the record, my name is Karen Minnis, State Representative, House District 20. House Bill 2767 deals with unemployment benefits for domestic violence victims. This is a bill that we shepherded through the process last session, and that the governor ultimately vetoed because he had concerns about some other issues that were incorporated into the original bill. And so rather than sign the bill into law, he worked with the Employment Division, who put an administrative rule into place. Currently, there's 193 people that have taken advantage of this. This would allow victims of domestic violence with a record of abuse. There are certain criteria they must meet, such as taking out restraining orders, not living with the abuser, things such as that, where there's a proven record, that would allow them to leave their employment and collect unemployment benefits in the search of a new employment. Last session, while this very issue was being discussed, there was a woman here in Salem whose abuser found her at her place of business and killed her, because that's the only place he knew to find her. So this would allow people, not just women, but men as well, to leave their place if they have to go find other employment, because the place of business is the place where they have to earn a living. If they have to leave the job for their own safety, this would allow them to do that and not starve in the process while they're looking for other employment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions from members? Probably not, Senator. All right, no further questions. Anybody else here to testify on House Bill 2767? Work session, House Bill 2767.
Yeah, I move House Bill 2767 A goes to the Senate floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2767 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Yeah, how come you never move my bill? That's what I want to
do. You haven't asked.
Maybe not in the same way.
Please hold his hand.
Okay, no further discussion of any serious content. Motion passes. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
All right.
I'd like to carry this bill.
There's fire.
Don't tempt me. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to carry this bill if a good Representative Minnis wouldn't mind a motion to be referred to the committee.
That's why she's leaving so quickly. I'll carry the bill. All right. Having disposed of that matter, let's move on to. Let's see what we got. We have a work session on Senate Bill 667, and I think we have someone from the Legislative Council here. Yes, no, maybe. Is Virginia here?
Yes,
I saw her come in.
What?
Would you ask her if she's ready or if they're ready?
Oh, yes, one?
I was going to do 667.
Oh, okay.
If they're ready. Not for
I don't
her,
think,
not
they're,
ready.
I don't think they're ready.
We're waiting for Senate Captain Dick.
Oh, okay. That's okay. We'll just go into a public hearing. House Bill 2945. And let's see. We have a host of individuals here. Scott Manchester.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Manchester. I work for the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research in the Department of Administrative Services, here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2945. Our concern regarding this bill is that it's not necessary. It's a bill that would extend the provisions of the Oregon Public Meeting Law to some advisory committees related to the Oregon Health Plan that are currently not subject to that law. The implication is that there is a problem with public input in relationship to the Oregon Health Plan. There is not. The Oregon Health Plan is known internationally as having made particular efforts in opening up the decision-making process to the public. So we are opposed to this bill because it extends provisions of the law and implies that there's a problem that doesn't exist. It's being proposed by the pharmaceutical industry. My understanding from listening to their testimony on the House side is that they are particularly concerned about one particular subcommittee of the Oregon Health Plan contractors. But this bill would have a much broader implication. It would apply to dozens of different committees throughout the Oregon Health Plan, for which do currently allow for a considerable amount of public input. I also took a look at the A3 amendments.
Before we get to the amendments, Senator Courtney has a question.
That's the question.
That is the question.
I was curious to know where he was.
All right. Go ahead. They actually haven't been introduced by the proponents, but you can go ahead and speak to them if you wish. I think we've all got copies of them. We'll be flexible here.
The bill was amended on the House side, and it was made better by the amendments on the House side. One of the concerns we had with the original bill was that it may be read as applying to meetings of internal staff work groups, and that was clarified by the amendments on the House side that it is not. The A3 amendments would make the bill better also. But I think what they would do is make the bill fairly close to the existing provisions of the current public meeting law. The way the bill would be reworded through the amendments would be to say that an advisory group convened to make decisions for, conduct policy research, or make recommendations to the Department of Human Services on administration or policy related to the medical assistance program operated under this chapter. That's the groups that would be applied to this. The current public meeting law applies to governing bodies, and a governing body is defined as a public body which consists of two or more members with the authority to make decisions for or recommendations to a public body or on policy or administration. So if you compare those two definitions, what this bill is being turned into is going to, through the A3 amendments, would be really very close to what the current public meeting law definition is as to which public bodies are subject. So again, the concern we have is that this is not necessary to the extent that the bill is simply reiterating provisions that are already in the Oregon public meeting law. That would be another reason for the argument that the bill is not necessary.
Okay, let me ask you the obvious question in my mind, and that is, why would you not want it to be open? In other words, what are you hiding? When did you stop beating your wife?
Mr. Chair, I should note that if the A3 amendments went through, they would not apply to our agency. But the issue that we're raising is not that we have anything to hide. It's that we've been completely open and that, therefore, we don't need this provision.
Okay. So if you're completely open, why not allow the public meetings law to apply?
Because it entails additional paperwork on our part to give notice for certain subcommittees that we currently don't have to give notice for.
It's public notice, and it's too hard to allow the public into the deliberative processes of your agency?
They are.
No, I'm saying that we already make great efforts to bring the public into our deliberations, and that therefore it's... public notice is generally aimed at media and at interest groups.
What's the compelling reason that your agency or any other agency in your position has to prevent the public from knowing or being allowed into your discussions?
Mr. Chair, we make every effort to bring the public into our discussions.
So what's your opposition to the bill?
Unnecessary staff work involved in giving public notices.
So you don't want to give public notice, that's what it boils down to. You don't want to tell the public about the meetings to which they're entitled, in your opinion, to attend.
Yeah, pretty weak.
Mr. Chair, the public is informed of the meetings of all the decision-making bodies, the public notice. The public is involved in subcommittees that are currently not subject to the public meetings law. And we don't think we have a problem in regard to public input into our processes that goes beyond what exists anywhere else in public government in the state of Oregon. This bill implies that we do, and I don't think we do.
You're starting to sound like an alcoholic. But what you're telling me is that you don't have a problem, your meetings are open, everybody's invited in, we just don't want to provide notice. Is that accurate or not?
Formal notice as required in the public meeting law.
You don't want to do that?
For the subcommittees that are currently not subject to the public meeting law.
Okay, so there are subcommittees. They're actually developing policy, right?
They're not making policy decisions, no.
What are they doing?
They are making recommendations to boards that do make policy decisions that are subject to the public meeting law currently.
All right, Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, but doesn't it sort of read also that it's that work that's being done that leads to a decision? It seems to me that that's what the subcommittee would be doing, right?
The subcommittees that we staff, yes, are doing work that would lead to a decision. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, another question.
Sure, go ahead.
So I understand you. The only thing you don't want, the bill's fine, except it's just a little extra paperwork for you. Is that the only problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, the main problem with the bill is that it applies a standard to Oregon Health Plan that other state and local governmental agencies in Oregon are not subject to, and we don't think there is a justification for applying that sort of standard to our committees.
Mr. Chair, then maybe we should correct the other state agencies too, then. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, if that were done, that would solve that problem.
You'd be happy.
You wouldn't mind if we started with you, though, would you? Your agency, you got to start somewhere. We'll use you as a pilot project. Give me the compelling reason.
Mr. Chair,
reason
if you
why,
wanted to do that, that's within your discretion.
Give me the compelling reason why the public or the media shouldn't have access to these committees that are deliberating to send recommendations to the policy committee. Why should they not be allowed notice, I guess? That's the key question here. Because you're telling me they can attend, so my assumption is then no one would be shut out if they in fact found out about them and appeared to want to attend.
Mr. Chair, that's correct in terms of the committees that we staff. I don't know if that's correct in all cases for the committees that are deal with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, but in terms of our agencies, that's in terms of our committees, that's correct. What was the question again?
Well, I guess part of the question, maybe let me rephrase it. Do you ever have the media attending these deliberative meetings?
Mr. Chair, yes.
How do they get there? How do they know you're having a meeting?
Mr. Chair, they are most frequently in attendance at the meetings of the boards that are defined as subject to the public meetings law.
But I'm talking about the ones that aren't, because that's what the bill addresses.
If they aren't, they have probably heard about those meetings as a result of having called our agency and asked us, or as a result of having attended other meetings where scheduling of subcommittees were discussed.
So they kind of found out about it on accident. Something of that.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if it's accidental that they call us asking us what our meeting schedule is, but
I guess I'm just trying to figure out what the compelling reason is to not provide public notice to a meeting that to me it seems like the Oregon Health Plan is a very critical and integral part of, you know, a public policy discussion that we've been having since at least 1991. And as a legislator, I've been somewhat mystified in terms of how you ultimately get legitimate, correct answers with respect to how that organization runs or administers the program. And I'm a legislator, and assumedly I have access to people who are certified smart and can dig all this stuff out, and still I'm confused, unless I'm just a complete moron and can't quite wade through it myself. But so what I'm trying to figure out is, if I have such a difficult problem getting reasonable answers, then the public probably has even more difficult access. That's what I'm thinking. You understand?
Mr. Chair, I guess my response to that would be, we do whatever we can to try and make the public informed and to keep them involved in the process.
Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chair, I have a question. In these meetings, would public input be helpful to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, in most cases, yes, it would, and it is, in most cases, received at those meetings.
But only if they find out about it on accident.
If they accidentally find out. Is that accurate?
Well, if they're in attendance at the meeting, if, yes.
Okay. Senator Duncan, are you finished, or are you as confused as I am?
I was curious, Council, what kind of meeting is this? Excuse me, I should know this. Notice is required for public meetings law. Okay, I didn't mean to embarrass you.
Okay,
I didn't try to mean to do that. As I understand, Scott, the issue is notice and the additional paperwork and giving notice and that burden. I was just trying, for the record, to find out, and I should know this and I don't, what is the requirement to announce a meeting? So, do you know that, Scott? Do you know what it is? Maybe you know. Can you help us with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, in terms of who has to be notified?
Well, whatever the law requires us to do when we're going to hold to announce a meeting to the public so that we comply with public meetings law. That's okay.
Sure. What do you have to do that you don't want to do that's so difficult to do, that would create so much paperwork? What is it that you would have to do? Do you know?
Send meeting notices to our mailing list that has been established for people who are interested in our meetings. That would be the additional work we would have to do as a result of this.
May have to be some kind of other official notice that maybe, and I think there probably has to be another kind of official notice as well for the general public, even though the public may never hear it, but I think you've got to do.
No. Generally, it's just to the agency's mailing list, and any member of the public is able to apply for that, and usually that mailing list would include newspaper organizations.
Okay. So, Scott, can I assume, just another question, please.
Sure.
Scott, can I assume that that's what you do pretty much now anyway, because you say you get input and things, and so can I assume that that's pretty much what you're doing now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, We do notice now for the groups that are defined in the statute as governing bodies. We sometimes do not do a formal notice for meetings of subcommittees of those governing bodies, which are not decision-making bodies. We would have to do so under this statute.
And so the list, you've got the list already, right? You don't need to make up a new list.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, The list is constantly changing as people express an interest.
Okay, but well, I think probably what's happening here is the chair is right. This is believe it or not, an open meetings of public records law, although we've created a tremendous number of exceptions to the public records law. The fact is, the burden, I think, is on you to show what the compelling interest is as to why you should not come under this open meetings law. It is, I really think that's the approach that, hope you understand it, you have to take. It's not like we have to prove it. You got to prove it, because I think automatically this is either public enough or quasi-public enough that automatically it happens, unless it fits one of those exceptions, Northern High Council. And does it, I mean, I'm not, for all I know, they may be violating the law, right? I mean, I don't know what's going on here. But we may have a violation going on right now. I'm not trying to shake you up, Scott, but I from what you're telling me in terms of policy making and things like that, you may be under this law and not start doing it now to begin with.
Do you have an attorney general's opinion to the contrary, or ever asked the Attorney General for an opinion, or letter opinion, with respect to whether or not these meetings come under the public meetings law?
Mr. Chair, meetings of subcommittees that I'm not aware that we've had a formal opinion or that there have been any complaints from people who wanted to attend a meeting that were unable to do so.
Right.
That's the sort of thing that would generate a request for an opinion on our part.
Council?
Yes, thank you, Chair. It looks to me, looking at ORS 192.610, which defines governing body, it says, means the members of any public body which consists of two or more members with the authority to make decisions for or recommendations to a public body on policy or administration. So it's with the authority to make decisions or recommendations to a public body on policy. Now, as I understand it, it depends on what the recommendation, who the recommendation would be being made to, and if it was being made to a public body, and also who was actually in attendance at that meeting. And I'm sure that you as legislators know that you can run into public meeting problems if too many of you are in one place at one time talking. So it could be sort of problematic depending on who was actually in attendance. If the subcommittee is really not made up of anyone on a formal governing body, or there was less than two people there, then it wouldn't be under the public meetings law. But if two people were there, then it would fall under it. So abundance of caution would certainly say that those probably should be noticed.
Right. Senator Courtney.
I called Scott because I served on the VMA task force with him, so that's why I'm taking the liberty of calling him by his first name, although I may be insulting you. Scott, you know what maybe you should be arguing is you want the bill amended to exclude you from the open meetings law. I mean, I don't mean to be a smart aleck, but that, I don't know. I think it's very interesting what I just heard in terms of whether or not you're already under law, and I realize the bill's already come out of the House, et cetera, et cetera. What?
I'm talking out loud, sorry.
The bill didn't come out of the House?
No. I was thinking of it. I verbalized my thoughts. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Mr. Courtney.
The discussion we're having right now.
Yes, it was.
That so stunned me that I've lost everything I want to say now. I'm going like, I don't get many good thoughts, and so you can only run with it when I do, and you just blew it. So I have nothing more to say, Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan had it.
That almost threw me. Mr. Chair, I have a question, Scott. Okay, give me an example of numbers. What are we talking about? We're talking about committees of what? And the numbers that would be in those meetings. Okay, we're getting picky, but I think we're trying to get at it here a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, our agency is a small agency that's involved in policy work. We staff, in terms of standing committees, the Oregon Health Council, the Health Services Commission, which does the prioritized list, the Health Resources Commission. Each of those groups from time to time have subcommittees and work groups. We also have committees that are assigned to us to staff from time to time, such as the Genetic Research Advisory Committee that Senator Courtney referred to. Genetic Research Advisory Committee, clearly subject to the public meeting law. All of its meetings were subject to public notice.
Mr. Chair.
It had several work groups around particular tasks. Those work groups we did not do public notice on.
Senator Duncan.
I'm just trying to get a feeling then if you have a subcommittee of the commission, of a commission, are just a couple of members there? How many members of the commission, for example, do you have?
The health services, well, the Oregon Health Council, I know how many they have. They have nine members.
Nine members, okay. And a subcommittee might be of what?
Subcommittee would probably be typically be several of those members plus some additional people with expertise or interest in a particular issue. Like maybe half a dozen people.
And they're making a recommendation and to the full commission, and the full commission has to act on that recommendation.
Correct.
All right. You're in opposition to the bill, and I'll let you go first, so I want to, and we've kind of roasted you a little bit here, but Senator Metzger's got a question, and then we'll bring up the proponents of the bill.
Well, I was actually just going to make a comment. Scott, I won't flog you any further. You've got three members of this committee who are the ones responsible for opening up the Democratic caucus, so I think you're maybe on a losing side here. But I do think, I think it is an important point. I think what the chair brought up is that, you know, I think philosophically, you know, you have to have a compelling reason not to be open to public meetings law. And, you know, throughout the questioning, the chair and others and the committee, the only reason that was given is that you didn't want to go through the process of publishing those. There wasn't one substantive reason. And you said they make recommendations to groups that then are public. So that means you've already got the system in place. You just don't want to have to do it to other groups. And I think in the absence of any compelling reason that I think they should be public. So I just want to make that comment and appreciate your effort.
Scott, if you want to kind of stand down, and we'll let the proponents of the bill have their say, and then...
I'd be very happy to stand down.
Thank you, sir. All right. Thank you. Bruce Bishop? Now, one of the senators just motioned to me that you guys can talk a lot or we can vote, so...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney with Harang Long Gary Rudnick in our Salem office. I am not exactly a proponent of the bill, but I am a supporter of the bill as proposed to be amended. We did not request the legislation, and I'm not here appearing on behalf of any specific client interest, but it is my view that public advisory bodies that are making recommendations to public agencies should meet in public. I see no reason for private meetings in discussions of public policy. I would like to say that there has been testimony before the committee that the bill is not necessary. I'm one of those who believes that, in fact, the bill may be necessary. I have never been uninvited from a meeting convened by the Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research Office that Mr. Manchester represents. I have been asked not to attend public meetings convened by the Oregon Medical Assistance Programs of DHS to discuss the Oregon Health Plan, and I believe that's improper and would urge the committee to approve the bill.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. This is our bill. It would pass the House with only two dissenting votes. It was passed originally last session as a minor part of House Bill 2700, which did not go into law because the governor had concerns with other parts of the bill involving copays for the Oregon Health Plan. But this part was uncontroversial after it had cleared the legislature last session. This bill applies to the Department of Human Resources, and one of the interesting ironies in the preceding witness's testimony is that it does not apply to his agency. So I'm really kind of mystified. That's a DAS agency. Office of Health Plan Policy is not a DHR agency. So I think that the concern may actually be with the very substance that we're attempting to get at here. There is a particular subcommittee of the Medical Directors Advisory Committee to the Oregon Health Plan called the Formulary Subcommittee. That's a word that's gotten a lot of discussion around this session. And in fact, we had extensive testimony as summarized in Chair Williams' memorandum floor letter on the House side that this particular subcommittee was in fact meeting behind closed doors and systematically excluding members of the public. And this committee, the testimony suggested, and I'm just here quoting from Representative Williams' floor letter, the testimony suggests that the exclusion of the public from these meetings has been directed at representatives of the drug industry, and I would add other members of the public. And that OMAP has been operating as an enabler to facilitate closed discussions among competing HMOs of such topics as prices, product offerings, and pharmaceutical rebates. These discussions raise for me, and this is Representative Williams, serious issues under provisions of the Sherman Act and other state and federal antitrust laws. This bill would open up, would extend the Sunshine Laws to these meetings that really involve some of the most difficult important issues in the administration of the Oregon Health Plan. I think it is absolutely essential that not only our industry, but the press and other members of the public have access to these meetings. and that hopefully public access will act will not only facilitate better discussion, better input, but serve to some degree at least as an antitrust compliance measure. I commend the bill to your attention. I would also commend to you the -3 amendments, which are I think clarify the bill and make it a little bit more certain as to its terms of applicability. With regard to the issue of the current public meeting law, we did have an informal opinion from Legislative Council that while it was a member of the body had an informal opinion that while it was a close issue, it may not be that the current public meeting law applies to advisory committees like that. So it's an important bill to pass in the public interest. Be glad to answer your questions.
Senator Duncan.
Mr. Gardner, do you know any members of the press, have you heard, talked to them about who have been excluded from these meetings?
No, but we did have last session, we did have a strong letter of support from the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, and they've been busy on other issues this session and did not want to get involved, but they felt that the prospect of exclusion was sufficiently, last session, was sufficiently serious that they needed to weigh in.
All right, Senator Metzger. Yes, I have a question regarding the -3 amendment.
Yes, sir.
You said you supported line 2 of the -3 deletes the word similar group.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me, you said you support it, so tell me why that doesn't give you any particular heartburn?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, when we analyzed the term or similar group, we didn't really see that it added any substantive content. And it could be a source of ambiguity, so for that reason, we were comfortable taking it out.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. First Crawford.
Hersh, you better have a compelling reason.
Well, I'm not sure that I have one that's going to be good enough, but we'll try. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Hersh Crawford. I'm the administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And in an effort to make this as painless as possible, let me just briefly summarize my testimony. Mr. Gardner has clearly clarified the issue here and that the purpose of this bill is to allow members of the drug manufacturers to attend the pharmacy subcommittee of the medical directors of the Oregon Health Plan to attend meetings of that group. We, in operating the Oregon Health Plan, we contract with a number of different managed care organizations to deliver services to people who are enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. Those contractors meet on a monthly basis, and those meetings are open to the public, as are all of our advisory committee meetings. A subcommittee, the medical directors, who are physicians employed by those private nonprofit HMOs, also meet monthly to talk about a number of issues of terms of coordinating care, quality assurance issues. They share best practices. They work on quality improvement projects, to work on a number of things. Those meetings are also free and open to the public. A subcommittee of physicians who are medical directors meets monthly, the pharmacy subcommittee, to talk about coordinating drug issues among the different managed health care plans, the degree to which their formularies may be similar or different, and can they change those. And they do, in the course of those meetings, share proprietary business information. And they have felt, and they do feel, that if those meetings were open to the public and open specifically to the drug manufacturers, that the purpose of those meetings would be significantly compromised. And therefore, we're opposed to this bill because we believe that it would inhibit the ability of the managed health care plans in their efforts to try and control drug costs and to control increases in the impact of drug cost on managed care programs.
Tell me, why is that your fear?
Mr. Chair, we believe and have been told that the proprietary business information that is shared in those meetings would not be freely shared if the meetings were open to the public, and that the sharing of that information is necessary in order for them to achieve their goal of trying to control drug costs. Now, I will also share with you that the results of those meetings are also reported in the full medical director's meeting, which is open to the public.
Senator Duffy.
Mr. Chair. Hirsch, is there, could you just kind of run through a scenario of what might be discussed? I mean, just give me kind of a scenario of what could happen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan.
I'm trying to picture what could be discussed, what could be happening in here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I will try and do that, although I have not personally attended any of the meetings. I believe that is discussed is what types of drugs are on particular formularies, what a particular plan may be paying for a drug, is that more or less than somebody else is paying for that drug. Maybe I can get a better price if I know what you're paying for that drug. That type of information, I believe, is discussed.
Mr. Chair, that certainly brought a response from the people behind you. I'm trying to figure out what that really means, I guess. Mm-hmm.
It means that they're still alive.
But the people behind?
Yeah.
Yeah, the people behind are.
So do you believe that the, and I don't want to focus on the pharmaceutical industry because it could be anybody who has an interest in the operation of this particular function of government right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but I think it's also important to acknowledge that this bill is brought to you by the pharmaceutical industry,
well,
is targeted
makes,
at a let specific
me my
group.
Question. I don't think that makes any difference, because the question I was going to get to was, do you not think the pharmaceutical industry might have something positive to contribute to some of these discussions? Is it somehow that the pharmaceutical industry is inherently evil and incapable of being constructive in these kind of public policy discussions?
Mr. Chair, we have actually held a number of meetings over the last year looking at ways in which costs could be controlled in the Oregon Health Plan. We have invited Mr. Gardner and Pharma to participate in all of those meetings. And while they were helpful, they were not particularly constructive in those meetings. I don't believe the pharmaceutical industry is inherently evil. However, I don't think they're interested in helping people look at ways to control drug costs either.
Interesting conclusion. Why do you say that?
Mr. Chair, because they profit from drug sales.
Okay, so absent their profit from drug sales, where are we going to get the pharmaceutical medications that you're going to provide to your programs, to your constituent groups? I mean, don't you think they have an integral part in this discussion? I mean, obviously they're for-profit mm-hmm. institutions, that's true. But don't you think that they have some interest in perpetuating the use of appropriate pharmaceutical medications and or the perpetuation of health plans just like the Oregon Health Plan? Wouldn't they benefit from the proliferation of a program and the appropriate use of medications within one of those programs? Don't you think they have something to contribute there?
Mr. Chair, I believe the pharmaceutical industry profits from increases in drug sales and increased utilization of drugs.
Where do they get those drugs?
Mr. Chair, they develop them through their research programs.
I see. And that costs a lot of money, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, it does.
Does the United States government do a comparable amount of research? Is there a government function that could easily supplant the research of the pharmaceutical industry?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I do. They don't. Senator Duncan.
Hirsch, I have another question. You have the advisory committee that makes a recommendation to OMAP, and then the final decision is made there. Just thinking back the last year or so, you probably have that fairly well in mind. When those recommendations have come to you, have you adopted those, or have you rejected those recommendations? How seriously do you take the recommendation coming from that medical advisory committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I want to be clear that if we're talking about the pharmacy subcommittee of the medical directors, I suppose they could make recommendations to us. I'm not aware that they ever have made a recommendation to us. Their purpose is not solely to make recommendations to us in terms of how the Oregon Health Plan is administered. Their primary purpose in meeting is to coordinate the drug programs across the managed health care plans that participate in the Oregon Health Plan. They may have made a recommendation to us, but frankly, off the top of my head, I can't remember one.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then, so someplace along the line, they made a recommendation to someone and something happens, right? Or do they just, or what's their purpose?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, their purpose in meeting is to work together to do a better job of controlling drug utilization and controlling drug costs in their various managed health care plans.
Thank you, Hirsch.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'd like to do a work session on this bill. Senator Duncan?
Mr. Chair, we're in work session?
Can be, if you're in.
Yes.
Okay. Work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2945.
Senator Duncan moves the adoption of the -3 amendments to House Bill 2945. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2945 as amended be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2945 as amended by the H-Ready amendments to move to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Say that I think that Senator Duncan should probably be carrying the bill because it was testified it doesn't do anything, so we might as well Senator Duncan carry it.
Well, I want to make a record. I think I'll carry this bill on the floor. I want to make a record. Perfectly clear that these deliberative bodies that are making recommendations should be open to the public. And I think using the ruse that pharma introduced the bill, or the pharmaceutical industry introduced the bill, is, I think, shameful, because I think it further perpetuates some fear that somehow there's some inherent evil in the pharmaceutical industry. I don't think that's true. I think it's disingenuous on the part of OMAP and the Department of Human Resources to even perpetuate the mere thought. And frankly, I'm offended by some of the testimony. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I'm in agreement with you, and I think that there is a provision for executive sessions. Now, if the executive session part isn't broad enough to deal with certain issues that you think should be in there, then that's an issue that should become before us. But actually, if it's a public meeting, public body, you should meet in an open meeting. And, you know, not that the legislature doesn't violate that itself once in a while, but nevertheless, we should all be adhering to it. And if you want to change if there's something of a nature that leads to something that's going to be destructive in negotiation, then that's a cause for a reason to ask for a change in what comes under the exception of executive session. And that's where it should probably be changed.
I agree 100%. Okay, we're done. All right, are we ready with 667? Work session, Senate Bill 667. In bonk?
What's 667?
We're done with the... What bill are you on?
It's gone. We moved it.
People shaking their head like they don't know what happened. The bill. No, we moved the bill.
We moved the bill too.
No, you gotta be on the job here if you're gonna follow our committee. It's gone. I'm carrying the bill. Up to including my critical comments.
Take the opportunity to rail against the pharmaceutical industry as far as carrying the bill.
Yeah. All right. What are we doing here?
Mr. Chair.
This is the motion for a new trial based on DNA evidence, so on and so forth.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn, representing the District Attorney Association. You had a hearing on this bill. We've had a work group since your hearing. Professor Winter was a part of that, the ACLU, the Oregon State Police, the Judicial Branch, DA's Association, Department of Justice, and OCDLA were all part of the work group, and you have -1 amendments, which are the result of the work group product, and
We have attempted to create a procedure that would be available for primarily to deal with people who have been incarcerated and are incarcerated now, or who have been convicted of very serious crimes, a process that if they believe that evidence is available, which if tested with a DNA testing, that would provide exculpatory evidence and prove their innocence, that this would be a process available to them. We have put it in the new trial format rather than a post-conviction proceedings, primarily because it just fit our legal process better. That was the consensus opinion. But as you work through the amendments, you'll see that in Section 1, we're describing who it is this applies to, and it's people who are incarcerated, Department of Corrections at the present time, or others convicted of murder or sex crime, which would require registration. So crime that has lingering repercussions for them. Then in Section 2, we go into the criteria. There also is a timeline of 48 months for this testing. I will tell you that we used as a guide for our proposal some legislation pending in Congress right now, a federal bill. It does have a shorter timeline, 36 months, but we believe 48 months was appropriate, and to make sure that that people who truly do have evidence that may exonerate them and DNA testing would assist, that they have the capability to have this process available to them. But then we go through in Section 2, and it provides some of the criteria for the legal process. And one important test here is that identity of the perpetrator was at issue, and that's at line 11 on page 2. That's important because that's really what DNA evidence really gets at in a legal proceeding. It can show that here is bodily substance from a person, and it will identify that person. And that's really the one thing DNA can prove. It can't magically prove innocence in other types of things unless there's fact-specific information. So that was, we thought, an important factor. And as this goes through, it provides a motion proceeding, and the court would make findings. And that's carried forward on page 2 and 3. It also takes into account on the page 3 what happens if there's an appeal pending now or post-conviction appeal pending, and it allows for stay of those proceedings if, in fact, DNA testing would be important and would be ordered by the court. Let's have that test available because it may moot out the need to go through the appellate process. And so we've tried to handle that issue. On page 4 in Section 3, we've tried to balance this out. One of the difficulties is when you create a new legal process, is that going to create a huge fiscal impact and overwhelm the courts? And so we wanted to have some tests in here to prevent that from happening, and that's why the identity was one important test that I talked about. Another one that we thought would be helpful to prevent just a huge amount of state-paid testing is Section 3. And that is, if these results come back and they're unfavorable to the person or inconclusive, these results would be forwarded to the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. It also would, the DNA results would be placed in the DNA data bank and be available for a screening of other unsolved crimes. So it gives the idea that if you're truly innocent, you want to make this request, that's fine. If you're just putting this into the system, and the system's going to have to respond to this, and we're going to have to put some money out for this, and this is not going to exonerate you, but may inculpate you in other crimes, you need to understand it up front, that that's exactly what will happen. So don't just put in some fabricated response for this. That's what we're trying to do, and we're hopeful that that will keep the fiscal impact on this, help keep it down, because that's one of the issues that we have to deal with. But then, lastly, what is covered is, well, two other things. This will have a fiscal impact because there is indigent defense costs, and we do think that this process will work better if a lawyer is involved, because otherwise we will just get a lot of handwritten notes from prisoners at the state penitentiary, and it's going to be a very difficult process for the courts and the system to use and utilize. And so there is Section 4 that talks about the process for appointing counsel, getting counsel involved once an inmate makes a request, and has these tests in place that there needs to be the fact that identity was an issue and innocence is the issue that's raised from DNA testing. And we do think that counsel also can help screen out some of these requests that will not be supported even to get into the legal process. The last section, Section 5, is requesting that, in effect, there be an interim study group on this process and to look and see, has technology changed? Should this be broadened? Is the time limit, the 48-month limit, should that be extended? Are there people who are being denied access to this since we've had to put some tests in here to restrict the fiscal impact? And is evidence being appropriately retained? Are there situations where evidence is being discarded and so this testing is not being fully effective? So those were some issues that were raised, and we thought that a interim study would be appropriate, or monitoring maybe more than anything on the whole process. I believe that there is agreement by all the parties involved and we bring this these amendments to you as supported by all, and we believe it is a good process. There are a couple of things that are still left open. On page 5, in lines 20 through 22, there is a slight technical adjustment that needs to be made in that in appointing counsel, here we've inadvertently left out some counsel that should be considered there. We've given that language to Virginia Vanderbilt. We could repeat that language to you today if we needed to do that, but...
we could have it amended, Mr. Chair.
Virginia later. Was here earlier.
She was. She apparently had to leave.
Okay. How difficult or how complex is
it's
that?
Easy.
It is one sentence. In effect, we would on line 20, where it reads, an attorney appointed under this section, comma, we would add a sub A in parentheses, and then it would read forward as printed. And then on line 22, where it says ORS 135.055, we would strike the period and place a semicolon and add a small b in parentheses with the following language added: if counsel provided pursuant to ORS 151460 is entitled to expenses as provided in ORS 135.055. That would be the addition and would expand that out because we were inadvertently restricting appointed counsel availability on this. The only other issue that is out there, and I can certainly repeat that, I guess there should be an or before the little sub B, so we're having an A and then a semicolon and then or and then the little sub B, if counsel provided pursuant to ORS 151.560
is entitled to expenses as provided in ORS 135.055, period. That would be the language. The last issue is that we've been attempting to work on the fiscal. It is certain that it will be over $50,000, and so there should be a referral to Ways and Means. However, we've been trying to track other states and their experience with this type of statute, and we're still completing that. State police and judicial department are working on that, and we believe that will be available shortly. But it will result in a referral to Ways and Means. But so we don't have that data for you today, but we think we'll have that shortly for you. But with that, if we can do that short amendment by interlineation or today, this is ready to go forward. We think it is a step forward and is a good bill. I don't know if you wanted any other comments from people. I will add one other thing, Mr. Chair, for the record, if I might. The Chiefs Association, Sheriff's Association, State Police all support this bill. We have committed that we would send a letter out to the different agencies advising them of this bill and requesting that they not destroy any evidence now in cases that may fit this criteria as we've set forward. So we wouldn't run into a situation where this may become available and in a few weeks before the bill takes effect, the evidence would be destroyed. But so we've made that commitment, and we're in the process of doing that.
Okay. The fiscal issue is somewhat perplexing. There is no fiscal. We don't have one, right?
Mr. Chair, would you like to start? Or?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'm Christian from the Judicial Department. The fiscal is threefold, I would say. It is the impact on the courts of having what we would hope would be very few cases, actual motions filed with the courts. I think the work group has narrowed this bill tremendously from what both it and House Bill 2416 started out. So it's a court impact. There's also the cost of the DNA testing, which, having just read the Oregonian yesterday, I thought was perhaps $45 per test, but that's what Captain Dixon can address. Under the bill, the indigent defense account would be responsible, except for those instances where a person is not incarcerated or where a person is incarcerated and has the funds. Indigent defense would be responsible for the cost of the DNA test. I'm informed it's $1,100, am I speaking correctly, per test. Oklahoma has a bill that has been in effect for about 6 months. Their bill, their law, is, in my assessment, broader, in fact, much broader than Oregon's. And they have had 120 to 150 of these petitions filed in 4 months. I do not believe that will be the case in Oregon because of the way that we have written the bill. But if there were only 100 over a full biennium just for the DNA test, that would exceed the $50,000. And the third of three.
All right. Senator Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you calculate the savings if we let them?
In prison beds, good point. Well, Senator Harper, I would expect that legislative fiscal would factor that in. So then it's a question of how many of these individuals will be determined to be truly innocent, and the DA and the defense attorney generally will work that out without court intervention. So
make sure that gets rolled in. There will be
absolutely, because one prison bed will offset.
Okay, Senator Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to that point, I hope there are no savings in that case, and we don't have anyone who's wrongly incarcerated. But
I guess
whatever it takes to get the fiscal under 50.
As another question, I guess I still struggle with how you can prove a negative through DNA, and I'd just like to run an example. If there's someone in prison for rape, and you have a stocking hat left, there was no eyewitness, it was dark, and the victim, you know, didn't see who did it. If you take the stocking hat and run it, the DNA, and the hair is not the hair of the person who was incarcerated for it, does that prove then by this bill that that person didn't do it? Because in my mind it doesn't. It just proves that there was right. somebody else, a stocking hat there too.
Right. Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, if I can answer that question. There are two different issues here. First of all is, do we do a test? And we are going to restrict this to situations where identity is the issue. Because if we know that the crime was rape and the issue at the trial was, hey, we had sex, the issue is, was there consent? DNA doesn't prove one little thing about whether or not there was consent. Now, if it is a rape case, and the issue is, as you described, I have no idea who this person is, it's a stranger. However, DNA, and I'm going to use a different example, DNA in a rape examination, we're going to take samples from the body of the rape victim. And if in those samples there is a bodily substance, and there will be a DNA category for that, and we obtain a DNA sample from the person in prison, and it is different, then that would be an example of identity was at issue, and it is not the person. The person who had sex with this victim was not the person in prison who gave us this DNA sample. That would prove that they are not guilty. Okay? That is the classic example. Now, if the situation was it is a hair at the crime scene, that is not going to be conclusive evidence because there can be all kinds of explanations for that hair. The court may go ahead and, under the analysis, looking at the evidence and what could happen, say, we'll have the DNA test on that hair. But then we're going to have a hearing on what does that mean. And that's where the court's going to look at that. And in the situation where it's from the body of the rape victim, the court has the DNA evidence. They're going to say, hey, this proves something. This is going to prove innocence. If it's a hair left at the scene, it might, under the circumstances, prove something. It might not. But the court will have that in front of it, and that's the decision the court made. Should we order a new trial or not? And I'm just saying, in the situation of evidence from the body of the rape victim, I would expect, yes, the court will order a new trial under those situations. A hair at a crime scene, it's going to depend on the facts and circumstances, and the court's going to look at it and say, does that really make a difference? Does it prove anything?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Duncan.
I have a question. Maybe all of you know this. But let's assume there's a rape. One individual actually does the rape, but there's a second person there as an accomplice, you might say.
Right.
Is that person, what's the liability here? Is there a criminal offense? Is the guy charged with being involved with a rape?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Duncan, again, we'll get down to, you know, specific facts in a case. And that's why we need to have a court process, and really why we need to have lawyers involved, and we need to have a hearing. And so we've tried to set these standards. Yes, if someone is an aider and abettor in a crime, they can be guilty of rape in the first degree, even though they did not have sexual intercourse with the victim. They may be holding the victim down while some other person is having sexual intercourse. And if those are the facts, DNA really isn't going to prove one thing at all about the co-defendant who is an aider and abettor. But that is why you need to have a legal process here with some tests, because in that situation, DNA really isn't going to prove anything for the aider and abettor. But that's an example, and that can be taken into account in a process we put forward.
Senator Barr?
I ask one more question, and this probably gets more detail than I need, but just in a case where you have a multiple rapes of a single victim,
yes.
You convicted one person, not another person. This person asked for this. If bodily fluid is taken from the victim and it shows that it's not the same person who was in jail, but yet you knew there was two rapists, would that qualify then, or is that inconclusive, or what?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, that would be an issue if you had a gang rape situation. There are times, and I'm getting beyond my expertise on this, but there are times where we can get multiple DNA from the victim. There are other times where we have a contaminated DNA sample. But that would be a situation where then the court will look at those facts, and that will have expert testimony. What does that mean? And does DNA prove anything in this case where we have a gang rape scenario and we have contaminated samples? That would be an issue for the court to wrestle with under the precise facts available and the expertise knowledge given to the court. It may or may not, the bottom line answer to you, it may or may not, given the facts, prove anything. But that would be available for the court to consider.
All righty. Any other comments, sir? Now, when are we going to get a fiscal?
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Dixon. I'm with State Police. Part of the difficulty is we've contacted a number of states that have passed this legislation. Their laboratories show very minimal impact at this time, and I believe part of the problem is by the time the process works and gets to the laboratories, you're looking at a 6 or 8 month delay. So the best we can do, I've already alluded to Oklahoma, those are the ones that are actually made the petition. Those are not the true number that have actually been sent to the laboratories for analysis. That's the difficulty we're facing. I think the best we can do is give you our best estimate, and then time will tell. I truly believe you're not going to see...
You'll be out of session by the time you figure it out.
1 week.
No, sir. We can provide it before that.
Well, hopefully based on something substantive.
Yes, sir.
Other than we think.
Mr. Chair, if I could quickly, that's what we're trying to do, is base it on something of substance. And so I would hope that between Captain Dixon and I, we could have a fiscal done within a week.
1 week. All right. That's when we'll bring this back. 1 week, and we'll get the amendments to this.
Mr. Chair.
I can have a general question too, by the way. You know, DNA science is growing exponentially. And, you know, you're reading cases. I think there was a case in Oregon, there are several cases. I've actually read the article, but I read the headline. Some DNA evidence hitting on some old cases or something. But when it comes to rape cases, the statute of limitations is 6 years, except where the victim is a child.
Yes.
Seems to me that there may be some cases that are running up close to that statute of limitations, so that as we're collecting DNA evidence, we have physical evidence that may identify individuals involved in prior rapes. And I know that the fiscal would probably go up big time, but where we have identified individuals, we ought to maybe look at the possibility of extending that statute of limitations specifically where there is a hit based on DNA science.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, we do have a bill coming to you that does that.
This looks like a perfect bill.
This bill?
Yeah. Relating to criminal procedure.
Yeah, that's...
Works for me.
There is a bill that passed the House that is coming to you in rape and sodomy cases where DNA evidence is available. It extends statute of limitation to 12 years. I personally supported a 20-year extension, but it came forward to House Judiciary at a 12-year extension, and so you will be seeing that bill.
I kind of like loading these puppies up. Anyway, just a tendency I have. I don't know why.
No, it's part of being on the judiciary. You're going to be a judiciary, you like to load.
It's like plowing your mind and planting seeds. All right. That's the only other issue we have, so we'll bring this back in a week. And
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee is simple.